The following sermon is called Judah's Mercies and Transgressions, illustrative of the duties and dangers of the American nation. Delivered in the First Presbyterian Church of Allegheny, June of 1856, Elisha Pope Smith, pastor. The Lord's voice cries to the city, and a man of wisdom shall see your name. Hear you the rod and who is appointed it, Micah 9 verse 9. This text calls our attention first to the speaker and the complainant. Number two, the aggressor and respondent. Number three, the subject matter of complaint and delinquency. And number four, the dictates of wisdom and duty thus suggested. The voice of the Lord cries to the city. Does not this emphatic expression cries denote the earnestness of God and at the same time the stupidity and dullness of mankind? His great moral apathy must, to ensure any response, require this extraordinary appliance. The great design of God under His present gracious economy is to promote the moral order, reformation, and salvation of mankind, considered as individuals and nations, and this He does by calling them to trial, calling their attention to their defects and sins, and the miseries which they suffer, and the causes of them. He would not leave them to rest in their transgressions or to sink down in a moral slumber and slide unguardedly into hopeless vice, disorder, and crime. When, therefore, consideration, amendment, and prayer cease to be thought of, God lifts up His voice and calls their attention to eternal things. The speaker is indeed the everlasting Creator and Governor of all things, the proprietor of the heavens and the earth and all they contained. But He is the Lord God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abundant in goodness, and a special benefactor of Christian nations. He built this earth as a temporary home of His mundane children, and when they all began to be His enemies and apostate sinners, He began to be a Savior, and through the gift of His only begotten Son, He brought them a written revelation, the fruits of a full and all-sufficient atonement, and the offer of an eternal heaven, opened wide to repentant sinners so that He could triumphantly ask, what could have been done more to my vineyard than I have not done in it? Can you gaze upon the star-studded firmament of heaven and hear the nocturnal music of its balanced spheres, or fix your eye on the blooming landscape, the tranquil vale, the picturesque mountain home of the cheerful shepherd, the fruitful fields, grazing flocks, and meandering streams, the gladsome villages and cities of a prosperous and happy people? Can you look at man so fearfully and wonderfully made, with all his bodily senses, the inlets of joy, and all his facilities of intelligence, of comfort and pleasure, and doubt whether the parental heart of the Father of spirits, though forgotten and insulted by His depraved and alienated children, is not still compassionate and kind? Can you open this written revelation and see what moral and spiritual counsels and instructions He has given to a benighted world, containing rules of duty, personal, domestic, social, ecclesiastical, and national, so wisely adjusted, so comprehensively stated, so fitted to be the basis of all legislation and moral order? And above all, can you read the history of His providence, visit His holy courts and the tender and hallowed scenes of Gethsemane, and doubt whether He ought to be feared and loved? Yet this infinite being, so ready to bless and save us, so willing when communities and nations rightly acknowledge and reverence His laws, to hold Himself engaged to protect them, guide their counsels, perpetuate and foster the useful institutions, direct their affairs, smile upon their agricultural and commercial interests, and become the strength and glory of their country, is a complainant. He is the Holy One of Israel, who is constrained by His benevolence, rectitude, and justice to lift up His monitory voice and tell of the base ingratitude of offending persons and guilty nations. What dishonor to His name, insult to His feelings, and violation of His laws is comprehended in this indictment, as it respected Jerusalem and other communities, it remains for us to consider. Secondly, the cited invader of the rights of the God of Jacob is a government and nation of Judah, and by implication all Christian commonwealths whose circumstances resemble hers. She, in the first place, is presented on the theater of ancient history and the extraordinary attitude of a nation whose territorial possessions, public blessings, and relative ascendancy over all existing communities is immediately referable to the particular munificence of God. Her domain had for centuries been definitely reserved for her as a discovery of this Western world, as so late and so appropriate a period seemed intended to meet the aspirations of our oppressed fathers in the old world, and the subsequent exigencies of the American people. God had brought her Hebrew founders, and by previous discipline, as indeed He did our ancestors, out of a state of civil and religious oppression in a foreign land, to inherit a territory of unexampled fertility and excellence. For this end He had, with remarkable demonstrations of power and goodness, driven out and consumed the pagan tribes which originally possessed it, and given them a goodly heritage, impressing on all its territory the indelible inscription of His preeminent goodness. Is this the nation of whose impiety and ingratitude above all others heaven is now called to complain? Yes, it is Judah whose providential history, like ours, has been replete with the marvelous instances of His powerful interposition, redeemed from vassalage, the grasp of a despotic monarch, devoid of citizenship and the right of soil. He had planted them down in the glory of all lands, divided to them by lot their respective inheritances, and for ages had there protected and prospered them in the rich productions of their own fields and vineyards. The multiplication of the numbers, their cities, and their resources, so their herds and flocks, while there in peaceful repose they had dwelt under their own vine and fig tree, without any to molest them. In the days of invasion and conflict, God had raised up their Joshuas and Gideons and Jephthahs and Baraks and Davids to enkindle the national enthusiasm and lead their armies to victory and deliverance. Does not the citation of the text seem readdressed to our own republic? Extended states and vast resources so striking as the parallel. The wars of Canaan, the victories of Gideon, Asa, and Barak, realize their counterpart in the conflicts of the scattered and feeble colonists with the Indian tribes anterior to the Revolution, and our Washingtons, Waynes, and Putnams were led to ultimate victory through the singular tokens of the divine interference. Can the aged veteran soldier still surviving in the distance of 70 years, or can our younger population recall the scenes of Lexington, Monmouth, and Yorktown, the dark and desponding nights of the Revolution, and the brightening morning of our national independence, and not respond to the sentiment that it was Judah's God who led our fathers in a way which they knew not? We behold in Judah as she stands as an ungrateful defendant before the Lord, a kingdom to whom, amidst the comparative moral thraldom and darkness of other nations, He has given benign civil and social institutions, an advanced civilization, a good measure of political freedom, and the privilege of worshiping the God of their fathers according to the dictates of their own consciences and the statutes of His law. Possessed of a fertile soil, abundant harvests repaid the labors of her husbandmen, while her commercial wealth, the whole land being near to Tyre at one time, the first commercial city in the world, was perhaps equal to any of the surrounding nations. Engaged at times in foreign and intestinal wars and commotions, the arts and sciences, especially of letters, music, poetry, architecture, and sculpture, occupied her attention. The school of Samuel, founded for the education of the young Hebrews, destined for civil as well as religious stations, and a mission under Jehoshaphat of laymen, with the priests and Levites to go out to the remotest towns in the kingdom, and with the book of the law to teach the people, shows the attention given to the intellectual and moral culture of a quiet, religious, and happy people, so that in his reign it is said that the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the land that were around about Judah, and they made no war upon it. And we are told that after the age of David, hymns and songs were composed, commemorative of the great events of her history, and replete with sentiments of piety and patriotism, adapted to rekindle the national enthusiasm. Need anything be said to show you the analogy here remind you of the goodness of the Lord to us in these particulars. Precious is the boon of the unrestricted rights of conscience, more perfectly enjoyed by us than by the inhabitants of any country on earth. We read its worth in the struggles and sacrifices and most severe and painful sufferings which many noble-minded men have freely encountered to obtain it. Can you think of our commerce whitening every sea, our agricultural and manufacturing wealth and resources, our schools and seminaries, and not feel your bosoms glow with thankfulness? And if Jerusalem was known and venerated in far distant lands for its sacred associations, the manifestations of the presence and power of God to it, insomuch that Jesus Christ in his last approach to it before he suffered, wept as he thought of its wonderful mercies and deliverances, its holy martyrs and its aggravated sins. Is there no parallel here in the providential hand of God in our country's colonial and revolutionary history, and in the signal dispensations of his Spirit upon almost all parts of this extended republic, the tidings of which have surprised and gladdened the hearts of good men in remote climes? O favored Judah, what an example of national virtue and propriety, of moral and political excellence, did it behoove thee to offer honorable to him who thus exalted thee and blessed to thyself? And is the duty less obligatory or less needful to the world now as to our own country? 4. Judah, thus called to her account by the God of nations, stands before him loaded with the tokens of his long-continued friendship and her high national responsibility, the focus of civil and religious truth and influence for the good of all nations. But he stained deeply with unkindness and ingratitude to her divine benefactor. Do you not know, he seems to say to her, what I did for your forefathers, whom I ransomed from the tyranny and idolatry of Egypt? Have you forgotten how I nurtured them in the wilderness 40 years and drove out the nations before them? And have you not copied the idolatries and vices of these heathen nations and done even worse than they? Survey these goodly mountains and well-watered and fertile valleys and rich and varied fields and pastures clothed with flocks and adorned with flowers of richest hue and fragrance. And have you not crowned every hill with your idolatrous groves and high places? Behold yonder holy temple, its tasteful proportions and beautiful magnificence, its towers and walls and its appropriate altars, its hallowed utensils and abiding glory. And yet in this my house, my earthly resting place, have you not set up altars to all the hosts of heaven? And in this valley which skirts its walls, is there not idolatry's basest shrine of obscene and bloody worship, where you make your children a path through the fire and a Moloch? 3. We are thus led to contemplate the transgressions which by his holy prophets the Lord charges upon Judah, and for which her nationality is threatened, the particular forms of national ingratitude and rebellion we gather from this chapter of Micah, corroborated by the words of his prophetical contemporaries. First and most obvious, which a righteous God would likely bring against Judah and Jerusalem in the last century of their continuance, would be those gross immoralities and flagrant vices which were steadily going on to sap the foundation of their national independence and constitute them a ruined people. The prophet in the context speaks of fraud, dishonesty, lying, oppression, theft, licentiousness, murder, and bribery, and that extinction of domestic harmony, parental and filial affections which, with other crimes, resulted from inebriation and the excessive use of intoxicating drinks. These and like immoralities were somewhat checked in the wise and virtuous reign of Hezekiah, but were terribly reproduced and established by Manasseh, his son and successor, who set himself to corrupt the minds of the young by the worst principles, making himself an example of impiety towards God and of bribery, licentiousness, and iniquity before the people, and whose conduct thus became the cause of their national downfall. The vices which we have mentioned, together with profanity, Sabbath desecration, and debauchery, are like infidelity, atheism, and irreligion in general. The sins of the members of society considered as individuals and become national when the common sentiment and practice of the mass of society sanction their endurance, and when there are no effectual laws to restrain them, and when their inherent criminality before God and their destructive influence upon the public welfare are not appreciated. It often happens that communities become so absorbed in the pursuits of business and gain and enterprise that the agents of its commercial, manufacturing, and agricultural interests become in fact irreligious, and official agents of government become negligent of morality and virtue through the all-engrossing prosecution of men's worldly interests. The marts and workshops, the fields and county rooms and warehouses and thoroughfares of the state are so entirely disassociated from religion and the fear of God that the very associations and industrial pursuits of men and a firm hold which the love of the world takes of their minds becomes the ultimate sources of vice and immorality. Under the sway of covetousness, ambition, and political aspiration, they forget, as it were, to be vicious and skeptical in the ardor and impetuosity with which the great objects of public improvement or the prospects of gain and affluence impel their sleepless energies. These become, therefore, the times when God and duty are forgotten, and when luxury, immorality, and the decay of sound principles make great advances and anticipate the ultimate perdition of national prosperity and stability. The reference of this particular to the present state of morals in our country I will not attempt fully to express. Amidst the vast accumulation of its population from almost every part of the world and of every shade of character, and the augmentation of the sources and occasions of immorality, you will doubtless feel that we are approaching a great crisis in our national history when all the appliances of knowledge and restraint should be earnestly sought. But here we must, for the present, pause in our investigations and close with a brief reference, number 4, to the dictates of duty and of wisdom, which the utterance of the monitory voice of the Lord suggests. Are not these too plain to require elucidation? Number 1, it is for the men of wisdom, the patriots who love their country and its institutions, the Christians who revere the goodness of the Lord, to recognize and acknowledge the munificence and forbearance of the Almighty to the American people, the justness of his complaints of her ingratitude and sin, and the equity of his righteous threatenings towards guilty nations. Number 2, it is for them, while heaven still waits and holds out the strongest encouragements to reformation and a return to him through the merits of his Son, in these times of national apprehension, to awake to thoughtfulness, humiliation, and prayer. You see how invaluable are the civil rights and social blessings which this great republic now enjoys. And yet if the true standard of public morals and private example and sound patriotism is not upheld, constitutions and laws will be lighter than a feather to restrain those whose integrity and national morality is gone. Oh, that the citizens of these states of every grade and condition might rightly estimate this richest political boon that the wisdom and munificence of heaven ever gave to earth, and cherish an undying determination so to deport themselves as through all momentary selfish and sectional agitations or public perils at all hazards and sacrifices to perpetuate it till the light and power of national example shall spread it through the earth.